This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I can assure you tonight we're going to have a very, very exciting discussion. The Faculty and Community Advisory Program Committee of the Taubman Symposia from time to time isolates a theme that they want us to bring speakers to the campus. Some of you remember that several years ago we did a three-year cycle of the future of Jews and Judaism. And recently we made a decision to highlight these great civilizational centers of Jewish history. Not that we can do all of them, but tonight is really one of those centers, the ghetto in Venice. Now, let me just tell you that I met Shaul Bassi in the ghetto, and I was fortunate enough to walk through the ghetto with him, and I discovered that we just had to have him. He is a scholar, as you know from the program brochure, of international reputation. And in many respects, Shaul Bassi represents the past of the Venetian ghetto, the present, and most importantly, the future of the Venetian ghetto. So let's welcome Shaul Bassi to Santa Barbara to speak on Shylock in Venice.
Good evening. I'd like to start with a 3-minute long video.
Bringing the Merchant of Venice to the ghetto is a sort of exorcism. You know, we're trying really to face the ghost of Shylock that has been haunting this place for a long time. So, of course, there's all sorts of implications.
I thought I was being foolhardy, attempting a novel that's got the Merchant of Venice behind it. But for you to do a production of it here in the ghetto, do you not feel the weight of that?
I do, and I like it. I like a good challenge.
I don't know. It'd be great to do something at the end.
Cursed be my tribe if I forget.
There's a portion of Shylock that we can all enter into. And I feel the Shylock as the stranger, outsider, the marginalized one, is also someone that we all, a woman, a gay man, all of us have had moments every day where we feel like an outsider. Well, I'm not a part of that.
Shall I bend low and in a bondsman's key with bated breath and whispering humbleness say this? Fair sir, you spit on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time you called me dog. And for these courtesies, I lend you thus much monies.
Your younger Shylock, Sohrab?
Yes, Sohrab.
I love him.
Yeah.
I love what he does.
Yes.
A young man full of juice and wit and saucy and elegant and handsome. And why not? Because you know the way it's so often done, even when people are offering to do a modern Shylock, you get an old man, old man rubbing his hands.
Yeah.
Coming in like this.
Yeah, little pathetic.
There's no justification for that.
Go with me to a notary, seal me there your single bond, and in a merry sport, if you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such sum or sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleaseth me?
The idea of him being able to engage Antonio in saucy banter.
Yes.
Because it is saucy banter, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm going to take a pound of flesh from whichever part of you it chooses. He
yes.
did it salacious.
Salacious is exactly it. And then the pleasure and the kind of laugh. It's like, oh, well, that will never happen.
In 1516, the Republic of Venice decreed that the Jews of the city, most of them newcomers and refugees, should be confined to one peripheral square that was an abandoned iron foundry called Ghetto. In 1616, William Shakespeare died, leaving behind a corpus of 40 works, which included a comedy, The Merchant of Venice, that history has made his most controversial play, because of the representation of the Venetian Jewish moneylender, Shylock. On July 26, 2016, Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice will be performed in the Jewish Ghetto of Venice for the first time in history, marking the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death and the 500th anniversary of the foundation of the Jewish Ghetto of Venice. I want to express all my gratitude to the Hermann and Sophia Taubman Foundation and the University of California, Santa Barbara, the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center, and all the old and new friends that have invited me to this very, very distinguished lecture series. And I want to specially welcome and thank Leonard Wallach, Eric and Christina Rickmers, and Professor Richard Echt, who has been a wonderful host here Santa Barbara. This is really a special opportunity for me to represent the legacy of the Jewish Ghetto of Venice and to share with you some reflection on the daunting task of bringing Shylock with the help of Columbari Company that you just saw and I will return to at the end of my talk, to bringing Shylock to his ghetto for the very first time in an original production in English. And let me also thank the students of the History of Antisemitism class of Professor Richard Echt that today I had the pleasure of discussing the play with. Their questions and comments really stimulated more of my thoughts. Let me start with a preliminary remark that will help me frame a historical overview. I consider both the Ghetto and Shakespeare's play as fundamentally ambivalent documents of Western civilization, having been both instruments of intolerance and catalysts for cross-cultural understanding, vehicles of anti-Semitism and portals of knowledge of and sympathy for the Jews. The project that I'm presenting today is truly a work in progress that still requires a major effort in the alignment of many stars. We intend to take the full onus of this ambivalence, rejecting any univocal interpretation of the place or of the play, attempting instead to work into a major theatrical event the multiple historical implications of a unique site, when one that has seen its distinctly local name, Ghetto, become a global metaphor, Ghetto. While I was preparing this talk, I was asked to say something about my family's relationship with the place, and then I realized that I could tell the whole story of the Ghetto and its interaction with Shakespeare through that of my family. So my presentation is divided into four parts, corresponding to four different centuries and four people in my family tree. And part one is called Yosef. My first ancestor is Yosef Pardo, born sometime in the mid-16th century in Salonika, now in Greece, then part of the Ottoman Empire, a member of that massive Sephardic diaspora that had been expelled from Spain in 1492. I don't know how clearly you can see that. This is a family tree that was compiled by my uncle some 50 years ago. And if you look at this family tree, you can notice how almost no single individual from the Spanish origin in Prado de Castilla that gives the Pardo their name, to my grandmother in Ferrara, is born and dies in the same place. Amsterdam, Suriname, Skopje, Dubrovnik, Jerusalem, Verona, Ferrara, Venice. Sometime in 1580s, Josef Pardo decides to leave his native Salonika and moves to Venice. We don't know his individual motivations, but we know that he chose to join a relatively new Jewish community. There was, in fact, an incredibly diverse mosaic of different Judaic traditions: Italian, German Ashkenazim, Sephardim, and the descendants of Iberian Maranos coming together in a site called Ghetto. In 1516, as I mentioned, the Venice Senate decreed the removal of the Jews who had fled to the city after the rout of Venice at the Battle of Agnadello from the body of the city. It was decided to confine them to the former public copper foundry, Getto del Rame del Nostro Comune, used in the past to manufacture ordnance, securing the service of the Jews but keeping them safely at the margins. It is not clear whether it was the early German foundry workers or the incoming German Jews who could not pronounce the G of Getto and turned the Getto into the ghetto. And it is a curious fact that a lot of alternative etymologies continue to be offered in the face of this conclusive evidence of the origin of the name. Other Jewish isolated areas had existed before Venice, like in Frankfurt, but in 1555, Pope Paul IV decided to model new segregated Jewish areas in his territories after this Venetian site. From there, the name ghetto started spreading in space and time to other ethnic enclaves and countless other physical, psychological, and metaphorical forms of limitation and confinement. I understand that Quentin Tarantino referred to the movie composer Ghetto, irritating many people at a recent ceremony. And I guess that he and his critics were probably not aware that they were referencing a small square in Venice. And I'm looking forward to a forthcoming book by Princeton sociologist Mitchell Dunayer, Ghetto, the Invention of a Place, the History of an Idea, that is precisely an analysis of this global spread. Constrained within the narrow limits of an island, the ghetto became at once a place of segregation and a safe haven for refugees, possibly one of the best compromises in Europe at the time. When the Jews entered the ghetto, where rents immediately skyrocketed, they had to become very creative. Blocks became taller and the headroom in apartments much lower. 6 or 7 story buildings had to accommodate as many as 10 apartments. The new arrivals were given permission to build their places of worship as long as they were not immediately recognizable from outside, which explains why the older Venetian synagogues are incorporated into residential buildings. What you're seeing in the picture is the Canton Synagogue that takes the name from the fact that it's in a corner and from the outside is completely inconspicuous and inside is beautiful and all decorated with gold. In a city like Venice, known internationally for its architectural and artistic beauties, the ghetto still presents itself as the only large square in the city without a church or any arresting facade. It is quite likely that Rabbi Josef Pardo chose the ghetto, that at the time of his arrival had added a second smaller square for the Sephardic newcomers, not because of these regulations, which forbade the Jews to leave the area from sunset to sunrise and prescribed the wearing of a yellow badge during daylight excursion, but for other important reasons. An incisive account by a contemporary author summarizes the salient features of the society residing there. The ghetto was isolated, yet its isolation protected its residents. And they took their chances. They created a mini-civilization, a city within the city, invested it with its own myths, its subtle glories. There were 5 synagogues, one each for the German, Italian, Spanish, French, and Levantine communities that settled here, each community with history of dispossession, its journey in search of a new way to scrape a living. They made the ghetto a center of culture, complete with literary salons, an academy of music, a theater, and a place of commerce with inns for merchants and travelers. The main street was lined with bookshops, secondhand dealers, printing works, pawnbrokers, and banks. Venetians were drawn to the district as soon as the gates were unlocked at dawn. In time, the boundary between the ghetto and the city became more fluid. The ghetto was indeed a mini-civilization that provided, among other things, theological responses to King Henry VIII for his divorce from Catherine of Aragon, helped the rabbis of Amsterdam to build a community that would excommunicate Spinoza, enabled the publication in Venice of one-third of all the Hebrew books printed in Europe, including the first complete edition of the Talmud. Many of these cultural achievements, like the Hebrew books printed by Christians or the synagogues designed by Christians, were in fact collaborative enterprises. This is a picture of the ghetto as you see it today with the tall buildings. This is the Levantine Synagogue, still in use today. I was a bit nervous for this talk, and then I went back to the time I had my bar mitzvah there, and all of a sudden I felt nothing can be worse than that, and I felt it's better. Where my ancestor, Yosef Pardo, was called to serve as the rabbi. In 1601, he wanted to publish a new commentary on the Torah, consisting of literary interpretations taken from different classical commentators, and he gave the work to one of the leading figures in Jewish cultural life in Venice, Rabbi Leon Modena. A rabbi and a scholar, a great preacher and author and autobiographer whose life of Judah vividly evokes the intellectual life of the ghetto, Modena was a reference point for his community and far beyond it. The loss of two of his beloved sons, one for an alchemical experiment and the other was murdered by a gang of delinquents, caused Modena profound distress, and throughout his life he was obsessed with gambling. But he also remembered as the author of the first work written in the vernacular by a Jew with the aim of acquainting Christian readers with Jewish customs. The first introduction of Judaism, 101, was written by Rav Modena. His Historia de Riti Ebraici was in fact commissioned by the English ambassador Henry Wotton and written for King James I while Shakespeare was still alive, though it wasn't actually published until 1637. Jewish intellectuals, such as Modena, should be fully recognized as participants of the larger phenomenon that we commonly refer to as the Italian Renaissance. And the symbiosis between Jewish and secular learning that Modena had is epitomized by this poem that you can see here that he composed as a teenager, where the poetry lines sound alike and have approximately parallel meanings in Hebrew and Italian. This is not a translation of the one to another. It sounds the same in both languages. It is Leon Modena himself who also tells us that my ancestor, Yosef Pardo, became bankrupt and in 1609 moved to Amsterdam, where until his death, he served as rabbi of the Beit Yaakov congregation. So my ancestor knew Leon Modena. I don't know if he ever knew. Maybe it was too late. The most astonishing pupil of Modena's, Sara Coppia Sulam, an extraordinary woman who, with an incredible degree of self-confidence as a woman and as a Jewish woman, published poetry, drama, and philosophical works, resisting any plea to convert to Christianity and defending herself in print with wisdom and irony from the accusation of having denied the immortality of the soul. Where in the salon in the ghetto where she hosted Jewish and Christian intellectuals. It is finally time to bring in William Shakespeare as a reader. For centuries, European Jews had to serve as moneylenders in Christian lands. Since the end of the 13th century, the Jew as usurer becomes the figure of any illicit economic activity, the observer of the positive activity of the Christian merchant banker. In a book called Il Pecorone by Ser Giovanni Fiorentino, William Shakespeare found a plot that talked about a moneylender that wants a pound of flesh in return for his debt. Shakespeare never visited Venice, but he came across many books about Venice, and this is one of them. There are two major differences between this Italian source and the English play. One is that Ser Giovanni's Jew has no name, as he's from Mestre in the mainland. And that was written before the Ghetto was created. So what Shakespeare does is, without mentioning the Ghetto, presupposing it in the play. We may argue that this specific site originates the Shakespearean text as an indispensable non-literary source, since the social and cultural dynamics of the play are enabled by the new space legally constituted in 1516. The social interaction between Shylock and the Christian merchants, his ambivalent relationship with conviviality, the much-discussed contradiction between "I will not eat with you, drink with you" in Act 1, and the fact that he accepts an invitation to dinner in Act 2, and all the romance between Jessica and Lorenzo are all the result of the creation of defined and sanctioned space where Jews were simultaneously included and excluded from the city. The other crucial difference is that Ser Giovanni's nameless Jew loses his money at the end, but he's not forced to become a Christian. And you can see the last words that relate to this character in the source, where we read that, "Seeing that he could not do what he had wished, he took his bond and tore it in pieces in a rage." So that story just finishes with an angry Jew, but not someone who has to undergo conversion. Fascinated by the myth of Venice as the city of justice, as the cosmopolitan republic, Shakespeare updates that story and set it in the New York of its time. Venice was the New York of its time. What Shakespeare does is to create a far more complex psychology and theology for Shylock, making of him the best-known fictional Jew of all times. However, our modern sensibility may miss the subtle theological arguments that are woven into the play. And the most disturbing one is that the famous pound of flesh to be taken from nearest the merchant's heart resonates with two important theological and mythological points that the Christian used against the Jews: circumcision and ritual murder. St. Paul had famously said that circumcision is not circumcision of the flesh, it is circumcision of the heart. And so we may take the pound of flesh to be cut from nearest the merchant's heart as a sort of literal, once again, a Jew that misread literally a biblical teaching of the circumcision of the heart dictated by Paul. But with this pound of flesh, there's also the anxiety that Jews are actually interested in Christian blood. With the infamous accusation of ritual murder, the idea that to heal themselves every year, the Jews get the blood of some Christian child whom they murder. An accusation that took many, many Jews to the stake and to die, including some Venetian Jews in Piazza San Marco before the Ghetto of Venice was created. But in spite of these lingering myths of the cruelty of the Jews, the Merchant of Venice is also famous for that speech where a sort of plea for a common humanity that is often quoted in part, has managed to make Shylock, to some extent, a more potentially sympathetic character. And so now it is time for me to move, after this slightly longer introduction that was meant to evoke the creation of the Ghetto and the writing of The Merchant of Venice, to move to my second part, and to a second ancestors, called Momolo Mandolin. The important one was Rabbi Pardo. From now on, it's all, you know, downhill. It is time to introduce a new ancestor, and I choose the grandfather of my grandfather because of his distinctly Venetian name. It may have been Mendeley, it became Mandolin in Venetian. In 1797, Napoleon's troops pulled down and burned the gates of the ghetto, and the Jews begin their journey to emancipation. It is at this time that a new group of Ashkenazi Jews from Germany decide to make the ghetto their home. Once again, it must have seemed a good compromise. While the newly renamed Bassi, I don't know what they were named before that, were settling in the ghetto, a new romantic Venice was being created out of the vestiges of the old empire, forged in the literature of Byron, Wordsworth, Ruskin, all the way to Henry James, Thomas Mann, and Marcel Proust. This is the more recent family tree where we have the first notice of a Moise Bassi that came to Venice in 1798, so, you know, aware that the ghetto was no longer a segregated area, and his grand, one of his many grandsons was Momolo Mandolin. In this new imagined Venice, the ghetto has no part. Nobody writes about the ghetto anymore. It has become a repressed memory. A rare exception is given by the French romantic author Théophile Gautier, who stumbled upon the now dilapidated ghetto and projected onto its poverty an elaborate, racialized Orientalist fantasy. And I'll quote just a little bit. "Probably if one were to penetrate into those cracked and rotten houses streaked with filthy ooze, one would find there, even as in the ancient Jewries, Rebecca's and Rachel's of an orientally radiant beauty, rigid with gold and precious stones as a Hindu idol, seated upon the most precious of Smyrna rugs, in the midst of dishes of gold and of incalculable riches amassed by paternal avarice. For the poverty of the Jew is only on the outside." Although Gautier probably alludes to the Rachel of Jacques Lévy's popular opera La Juive or Walter Scott's Rebecca, the reference to the paternal avarice and the imprisoned daughter are clearly reminiscent of the Shylock and Jessica relationship in the play. If Gautier had really penetrated the rotten houses of the ghetto, he would have found the humble mention of Momolo Mandolin and the other Bassis. And this is another document that was compiled by a historian a few decades ago, where one, even if you cannot read, just believe me that if you look at the archive of the Jewish community, you can notice that how out of the first 10 Bassi born in the ghetto, 8 do not survive past the age of 5. And in the list of their professions, the prevailing occupation is industriante. In modern Italian, industriante means industrialist. But in the 19th century, it meant, in English, something like jack of all trades. In Yiddish, it would have been schnorrer. So that's it. So Gautier was totally misguided, but he was projecting his anti-Semitic prejudices onto these rundown walls. And he was misguided, among other things, because the more affluent Jews had long since left the ghetto to become active and prominent members of Venetian society. The American consul in Venice, William Dean Howells, visits the ghetto in the early 1860s and paints a picture of peaceful integration. "I say at the beginning that Shylock is dead, that if he lived, Antonio would hardly spit upon his gorgeous pantaloons or his Parisian coat as he met him on the Rialto, that he would far rather call out to him, 'Ciao, Shylock, bon dì, go piacer vederla. Shylock, old fellow, good day, glad to see you.'" Momolo Mandolin certainly does not know who Shakespeare is, but Shylock is becoming a more familiar and sympathetic figure on the English stage. We owe to Sir Lawrence Irving, the first actor that becomes a sir, in the 1880s, the interpretation of the moneylender as the type of a persecuted race, almost the only gentleman in the play and the most ill-used. So after two centuries where Shylock was predominantly a comic character or a villain, Lawrence Irving, in a way, has a new interpretation where he even invents a new scene where a silent act where he becomes the Victorian father that sees his daughter eloping, and the audience sympathizes with this father that has seen the daughter running away. But behind this sympathetic Jew, there's always the temptation of anti-Semitism. Someone as close to Irving as his secretary detects a lurking menace. It has often amazed me to see the physiognomy of Shylock gradually emerge from the actor's own generous countenance. I could never really understand how the lips thickened with the red of the lower lip curling out and over after the manner of the typical Hebraic countenance, how the bridge of the nose under his painting, for he used no physical building, uprose into Jewish aquiline. It is as if impersonating a Jew turns you into a Jew in a dangerous form of racial contamination. You may have recognized the name of Lawrence Irving's secretary because Bram Stoker, in fact, created another character that looks a lot like the Jews and, like Shylock, is hungry for Christian blood. And you may know that Dracula has always been represented with uncanny Jewish connotations. Part 3, 20th century. Girolamo Detto Gino, my grandfather, Momolo Mandolin's grandson. Born in 1892, Gino lost his father, Rabbi Yosef, in 1916. And as an orphan, he was at least spared the trenches of World War I. So his name does not appear on the facade of the Levantine Synagogue, where Yosef Pardo served as a rabbi in the 16th century, of the Italian Jews fallen for their homeland. This is the moment where the Italian Jews feel that they have finally achieved total integration into Italian society. In the same year, 1916, Girolamo Bassi, a devoted Anglophile, authors a short essay to celebrate the tercentenary of Shakespeare's death. Praising his ability, Shakespeare's ability, to soar above the superstitions of his times and criticizing the view that the Bridge of Venice is a celebration of Christian mercy against the strict law of the Jews, he concludes that Shakespeare created works of pure art and did not use the theater as a means to disseminate a faith or to fight a political party or a nation. His genius is eminently eclectical and by virtue of this, universal. So by praising Shakespeare, Gino Bassi, a lawyer, was also simply saying, now Jews and Christians, we're all part of a shared secular culture. Gino married Lina Ravenna, who was a descendant of Yosef Pardo, and this is how the two branches of the family come together in a mixed marriage between Ashkenazi and Sephardim. And I think that I could find, with the magnifying lens, my grandfather, whom I never met, in the audience of a historic production, the only other production, major production of The Merchant of Venice in Venice, outdoors, but very far away from the ghetto, the one of Max Reinhardt in 1936 in the square of San Trovaso, a production that has gone on record for the wealth and flamboyance of its scenographies. It was really, you know, reconstructed in a Venetian campo using the canal with a ship coming down the canal. As a witness to that production put it, the hero, the center, the heart, and essence of the performance is Venice, not Shylock, the ever-singing, ever-buzzing Venice, a city which rejoiced in the joy of life. its pleasure, delight, and exuberance, which felt like the capital and center of the world. And this is a picture of the audience of that memorable production. And now, for a slightly more disturbing picture, this is Gino Bassi and his three children, including my father, who's the one doing the fascist salute, wearing the uniform of the National Fascist Party. Gino is so sure of being fully integrated that, like many other Italians, he even joins the fascist party, whose nationalist agenda has initially no particular interest in the Jews. When my father put this picture on his book of memoirs that was recently published in English by the Primo Levi Center in New York, he says, "I hope some real neo-fascist buys it, thinking it's a fascist book, and then finds out about the Shoah." For some Italian Jews, becoming a fascist was the logical conclusion of a patriotism aimed at erasing any doubt concerning their Italianness and their loyalty. My grandfather did not wear the fascist uniform out of ideological conviction, like other Jews did. He became a member of the party to make his professional life a bit easier and to support his family. He was not as brave as many Jews who were actually active anti-fascists, like Primo Levi. But that did not save my grandfather from the race laws. In 1938, the fascist regime declared that the Jews were not only unworthy of Italian nationality, but they were declared an altogether different alien race. Exclusion from the public sphere and the withdrawal of most civil rights paved the way for the mass arrests and deportations of the final years of World War II, with approximately 8,000 Italians and 246 Venetians deported to Auschwitz, many of whom being the elderly who lived in the old age home in the ghetto. You can see how Italian racism was presented as an act of defense against the Jews, against the blacks, and Italy is represented as a lone child, a crying child that has been attacked by the claws of communists, Freemasons, and Jews. The last picture of this section is the one that represents survival and rebirth. The Torah scroll come back to the ghetto in April 1945. The community survives and modern time begin. The modern era of the ghetto begins. This is again next to the Levantine synagogue that we've discussed many times. Before I move into the last part of my talk and come to the last member of my family, just I hope a useful summary of the major historical moment. 1516, the ghetto is established. 1797, its gates are burned by Napoleon. 1866, Venice joins the unified Italy. 1938, the race laws, the deportations in 43 and 44, and then this new landmark anniversary, 2016, 500 years of the ghetto of Venice. The last member of the family I want to talk is my son, whose name is Samuel. He's 6. And in 2012, I woke him to his first day of school, a very emotional moment, as for all parents. But for me, it was something more special, because I took him back to the same school where 74 years earlier, my father, his grandfather, had been expelled because he was a Jew. So in that courtyard in a Venetian school, I really saw, like, in a way, my father. So the project that I'm working on with many other people in Venice is about thinking the ghetto in the present and the ghetto in the future. What the ghetto can represent for a new Italy, for a new, also, a truly multi-ethnic and multicultural society that Europe is truly struggling with. My son was born in Kenya, near the Nairobi slums, where millions of people live, and that they call, in the language, ghettos. So my son is born at a time where ghetto is no longer a Venetian or just a Venetian term, certainly not just a Jewish term. It has become a truly global metaphor. My son is born at a time when the ghetto has become a very popular tourist destination. I know that many of you have been there. A place of memory where the names of the Venetian deportees are written on a Holocaust memorial created by the Lithuanian artist Arbit Blatas. And the Jewish community is actively involved in remembering the Holocaust. And I told the students earlier today that I myself have given a few talks about the story of my family, and one day I received a phone call from a very kind person who had invited me to speak about my family at Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is tomorrow. And after thanking me for the talk, he said, "Well, I would like to seek your advice. A friend of mine needs to buy a big quantity of gold, and since I know Jews deal with gold, I thought you may be able to help." I was dumbfounded. This man was not an anti-Semite, or at least, you know, didn't think of himself as one. He had performed his civic duty of remembering the Shoah, but never like that day have I felt that the long shadow of Shylock is still shrouding the history of, and reality of the Jews of Venice. My son also lives in a time where Venice is not investing in quality tourism, but it's just trying to bring more and more people. And what is happening is that Venetians are leaving, these humongous cruise ships are coming in, and they don't allow for a real experience of the city or a real experience of the ghetto. It is in this context that the Jewish community of Venice and the city of Venice has decided to face the challenges of this quincentenary with several related projects aimed at reclaiming the area as going back to the origin, not as a place of confinement, but as a cosmopolitan center, a place where people meet and exchange ideas when they collaborate on books, on art, on many other projects, a place of dialogue and understanding. The main project is a full restoration of the synagogues and of the Jewish Museum, but it's still funny that the Times of London were describing the ghetto in its end line. It calls it Shylock's Ghetto. There you can help. I'm sure you've recognized Barbara Streisand, who is one of the supporters of the campaign, and I invite you all to join Barbara Streisand in supporting the same campaign. But also went to spend some more time on a different picture. This is Rita Dove, the first African-American poet to be nominated Poet Laureate of the United States. And Rita Dove has been one of the guests of our program where we have invited prominent contemporary writers to reimagine the ghetto. We reacted to this absence of the ghetto from the literary canon of Venice, and we said we want modern contemporary writers, writers who have a completely different sense of what a ghetto is, to respond to this place. And you can see her standing in a picture taken by her husband within the Spanish synagogue. And I'm very happy to share the news that just a few days ago, she sent some poems where she put herself in the shoes of Sara Copio Sullam. So the African-American poet of the 21st century sort of becomes the Jewish woman poet of the 16th century. And this is really moving and beautiful. So the ghetto is not just a place where things happened. It's a place where things are still happening. Which brings me, finally, to the project that you saw in the video. Today, tens of thousands of people visit the ghetto every year. They tour its synagogues and museum, gaze in wonder at the tall tenements and remnants of its famous banks. They read the memorial plaques dedicated to the Holocaust. And the small but vibrant Jewish population, 500 roughly, treasures its own traditions and participates in the civic and cultural life of Venice. However, the Quarter remains the most misunderstood and misrepresented monument of Venice. Because of its semiotic opacity and ambivalence, it is a palimpsest and a battleground where different people project their own understanding of what a ghetto is. Many people think that it's a World War II ghetto, where, as I've explained, it was not. While Venice presents itself in fixed images of eternal beauty or in its mirror image of decadence and moribundity, the ghetto fully depends on its historicity. It is a contested space where key values and concepts are constantly renegotiated. Inclusion versus exclusion, ownership versus lease, Christian versus Jew, secular versus sacred, tolerance versus intolerance. The 500th anniversary of the ghetto this year is a unique opportunity to open a new phase in the history of this site and to highlight its global relevance through a modern approach to its heritage. At a time of political uncertainty in Europe, the ghetto has precious ethical and cultural lessons to educate the public about the Jews, about human rights, cross-cultural and interfaith dialogue. This apparently marginal place in the world's most visited city is yet crucial for understanding how societies can engage in cross-cultural conversation to their mutual benefit. By unpacking the most famous myth linked to the ghetto, Shylock, we hope to demystify the stereotypes that have accrued around this exemplary site. Can the merchant in the ghetto add a new critical layer? Is the project violating or infringing on a sacred space? Does it impose the presence of the most hideous stereotypical alien? Or conversely, it is reconnecting two narratives, the ghetto and the merchant, that have existed on parallel levels for too long. Whatever the prospects are, the merchant in the ghetto is not a philological or archaeological gesture, and we are not looking for a politically correct production of the play. We don't want to turn Shylock into a nice guy to honor the memory of the Jews who were ghettoized and later persecuted here. Guided by visionary director, American director Karin Kunrod, that you saw in an interview with Howard Jacobson. Howard Jacobson is the most famous British Jewish writer, and he is rewriting The Merchant of Venice as a contemporary novel. The American company, Compagnia de Colombari, has not come to Venice to learn the right color of Shylock's hat. This international collective of performing artists has come to provoke a creative collision, one that addresses the ambivalence of the play and the place, one that unsettles its audience with Shylock's own words. I'm not bound to please thee with my answers. We hope that The Merchant of Venice could contribute to a renewed civic dimension of the ghetto based on a cross-cultural conversation that uses Shakespeare as shared language. We didn't want to have maybe a more famous Shakespearean company to produce their own Merchant of Venice in London or New York and then bring it to Venice. We really wanted that to be a site-specific production created in Venice while fully immersed in the place. So last summer, we spent 4 weeks together with the most famous Shakespearean scholars, Stephen Griblatt, James Shapiro, and Stanley Wells, and we had the actors, and we spent time in the ghetto, interviewed people. It was really a sort of wonderful moment of community. And as a very special bonus, while I invite all of you to come to Venice at the end of July to attend the performance of the play and be part of this historic event, we are tremendously honored to host, as a collateral event to the performance, a mock trial to Shylock and Antonio presided by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Anti-Semitism and racism continue to be urgent social and political factors in today's Europe. Grappling with the archetypal text of European anti-Semitism, we hope we can also shed light on new expression of anti-Jewish hostility, as well as new forms of ethnic and religious discrimination. As we start in the first ghetto, we bear in mind that today several other ghettos exist, both as physical enclosures, refugee camps, detention centers, segregated neighborhoods, and as metaphorical confinements where minorities and underrepresented groups are marginalized, silenced, oppressed. By reclaiming the ghetto of Venice as a cosmopolitan center of cross-cultural creativity and dialogue, we look forward to the next 500 years. Thank you.
We have a bit of time to enter into dialogue and discussion with Shaul, but what we need you to do is to come forward to the two microphones because we want to get your questions and comments on that. So who wants to start? Here's your first question.
Hello. Thank you for a marvelous talk. I'm just curious, was Shakespeare himself anti-Semitic?
Uh-huh. That question, was Shakespeare anti-Semitic? I don't know. I think that to some extent this is a misleading question. It's a very correct question. It's a question that needs to be answered. But I think that we don't really know what Shakespeare thought. We know what was available to him in terms of discourses. Shakespeare could not have no Christian at that time could have written a truly, I think, psychologically accurate representation of the Jews. So in a way, I think that Shylock is at the end of the medieval tradition of anti-Semitism, but also opening up some space for understanding of the Jews are real people. And in general, I try not to draw conclusion about Shakespeare himself. We don't know. And I like the fact that the play has been both used as anti-Semitic and as philo-Semitic. And I've seen people fighting very, very fiercely about that. So I think it's better that we leave the question unanswered because that it forces us to confront this play, which I think we need to do no matter what.
Thank you.
Thank you ever so much for a truly enlightening talk. And this is a question of innocent ignorance. You mentioned that in the 16th century when the ghetto was founded, that the residents, the Jews, had to wear the yellow badge. Was that an imposition on the part of the political establishment at the time? What was its significance? What was its origins? Had it, in fact, been part of their unfortunate designation in other areas of the world?
Well, it was certainly an imposition of the Republic of Venice. It was clear that Jews didn't look Jewish enough, and so they had to be dressed and marked with either yellow hats or yellow badges or red hats or red badges. It depends on the time, and there are sort of symbolic meaning attached to it. The only exception were doctors. Jewish doctors were the only one who were even allowed to leave the ghetto at night, and that meant they had to wear a black hat. So the idea is that at that time, you would immediately recognize someone from the way they dressed. And so the Jews were not exception to that.
But was this designation derived from some other cultural affair, either some other environment beyond Venice, or since Venice is the center, particularly as you pointed out, of the Renaissance and nowhere more important for color than Venice itself, that the colors itself seem to be of some significance. And since the yellow badge continued for centuries, as opposed to the red hat, perhaps, that there seems to me to be something quite significant about that designation, despite its devious and terrible associations.
I don't think that the color was unique to Venice, but that's a very interesting comment, so I'd like to look into the history a little more. Thank you.
In the past 400 centuries, were the Jews ever asked to leave Venice in toto? In the last 400 centuries, were Jews asked to leave Venice en masse?
The Jews were threatened
of expulsion a number of times. And so when we look at the whole history of the ghetto, we look retrospectively at a sort of continuous era. But in fact, a few times, especially in the 17th century, they had to renegotiate. In the 16th century, they had to renegotiate their charter. There was this agreement with the city. And so there was never total stability. But the fact that they built the synagogues certainly manifested their sense of having found a kind of home. So the only time they really had to leave was during World War II, when they were not actually forced to leave. They decided to leave, the one who could.
Are there Jews living there now?
Oh, yes, there are. I'm one of them. There are 500 community members, and there's also many others who are unaffiliated. So what I'd like to emphasize that there's really a very, very vibrant Jewish life in Venice that is offered both by the residents and by the many visitors who bring their different experiences. So I really invite you all to come and experience it.
With regard to the first question, it's my understanding that under King Henry VIII, Shakespeare, who was a Catholic, all Catholics had to go underground and practice their religion that way. And I don't know, I've never got that information confirmed, but that's what I read in a historical piece. And I wonder if you have any information on that.
Shakespeare was a Catholic. Shakespeare was a Protestant. Shakespeare was an atheist. Shakespeare was Jewish. Shakespeare was Italian. And Shakespeare was... The truth is that many distinguished scholars make compelling cases for Shakespeare's religious identity or political identity. But there's no consensus. We know that his father was Catholic, and there were many shades of Catholicism at that time. But I personally don't think that we can pin down his religious identity, because there's always the risk that we take a character that we like and we think that that was Shakespeare thinks. But Shakespeare was Proteus. He really could enter the lives and minds of people who were all these different things. I actually tend to think that he was quite radical in his religious ideas, but I really resist any identification of him in any way. Thank you.
Perhaps we might conclude this evening by allowing me to tell you a story. When Shaul Bassi was a graduate student, he took advantage of one of the great treasures of the University of California, namely its Education Abroad program, which allows hundreds, if not thousands, of students here in the University of California to study abroad, and also allows graduate students, in his case, to come to places like Berkeley and Santa Cruz and all of the other universities of California campuses. So perhaps we should not say goodbye, but we should welcome him back. Thank you.
Let me do like my ancestor Momolo Mandolin and try to improvise and try to sell you something. This is a brochure where you find all the information about the production this summer, way of contributing, whether participating, whether ways of joining the exclusive mock trial. So I invite you to pick up this on your way home. And this is a website where you can find all the information. See you in Venice. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.